Hello, I'm Rachel Lowell. This is number 0165, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there. Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0165. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, you'll meet actor Kevin Sorbo, best known for playing Hercules. Now, he's written a book called True Strength, My Journey from Hercules to Mere Mortal and How Nearly Dying Saved My Life. It tells the story of how he survived an aneurysm and three strokes.
It was near the end of season five, and I was coming back to shoot a movie here in the States. And about 3 months left of that last season five, I started getting really achy, throbbing shoulder pains. It was killing me, and I was getting cold fingers. My fingers were cold and numb, and I couldn't figure out what was going on. And when I got back to the States before I started the movie, I went to my doctor, and he said, "You got a lump in your shoulder, and I want to get a biopsy." Well, I went to see my chiropractor. He was working on my shoulder, and he cracked my neck. Well, within minutes, I suffered my strokes. It was later found that the lump in my shoulder and my left subclavicle was an aneurysm.
Joseph Scott Morgan is a retired medical legal death investigator who has written the book Blood Beneath My Feet, The Journey of a Southern Death Investigator. How is being a real death investigator different than what you see on TV?
You're missing out on the other senses, the smell. Even the sound has a tactile sense to it. You're around families, the mourning screams of a mother that's lost a child. All of those, your senses are completely assaulted on every level. Even the textures of things are appreciable. And so this has a lingering effect on an individual that actually practices as a medical legal death investigator. And that's the seminal point in my book.
Peter Franklin, the Gabby Cabbie, shares a slight of the Big Apple from his yellow mobile conveyance lounge, sharing stories like the art stolen by the Nazis that have found its way into New York museums.
Let me tell you something, kiddo. I guarantee you that half the stuff in the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York City probably isn't even there, as much as I would trust some of these museums. They just closed their eyes and just bought and bought and bought and never bothered to ask any questions.
And we have lots and lots and lots of stuff and, of course, an idiot of the day. The guest later, the person who told you this was show number 0165, was Rachel Lau, who's a student and also a web news journalist at Global Montreal, the other place that I work. Thank you very much, Rachel, for being the guest later on this edition of the Stuff File program. And of course, the Stuff File program is also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Let's get right to the stuff, shall we? Well, a fire that destroyed 8 units at an apartment complex in Holland Township, Michigan, is believed to have been sparked by a man using a propane torch to cook a squirrel for lunch. Yes, the resident was on a deck on the 3rd floor of the Clairview Apartments. He was using the torch to burn off the squirrel's fur when the deck caught fire, according to the fire chief. Now, the resident, whose name was not released, was removing the animal's fur in preparation to eat it. Flames spread to the roof and other parts of the building. 8 apartments were destroyed, and 24 other units were damaged by smoke and water. The unusual cause of the blaze quickly became the talk of area fire stations. "That's about as off the wall as it gets," said Plainfield Township Fire Chief David Peterson. "I'd say that's something that even the Clampets didn't do on the Beverly Hillbillies." Speaking of squirrels, it's just ironic that my latest photo follies, which you'll find on my blog, is a story about a squirrel. The story is entitled A Bitter Homicidal Rodent. You can go to the blog and read that one. Elsewhere in the Stuff File news, 2 14-year-old boys who stole one of their mother's jewels to pay for visits to a brothel have been charged with theft in Germany. The youngsters sold about $4,000 worth of gold and gems for just a little under $400 to a gold dealer in their home city of Karlsruhe. Now, they spent the proceeds on pizza, kebabs, and 2 visits to a brothel in the city's red light district. Officers said the pair had been caught in a delirium of hormones and had only got a tenth of the value of the jewels. You could still see the delighted smiles on their faces while they were being interrogated, said a police spokesman. Yeah, I'll bet. They've been told that damages will be awarded against them and they will have to pay it off out of their own pocket money, the police spokesperson added. Well, you know, considering the smiles on their faces, do you really think they care? Also, there's a lot of crime going on around here. I haven't seen a picture of these kids, but I am assuming they are 14-year-olds who look like 14-year-olds. What I would like to know is, when it comes to both the brothel and the gold dealer, why are either of them taking business from kids? And in the case of the gold dealer, what a ripoff! Moving right along, a U.S. brewery which announced that it was making beer out of bull testicles as an April Fool's Day stunt has now done it for real. The Wincoop Brewing Company in Denver, Colorado has named its creation Rocky Mountain Oyster Stout. Head brewer Andy Brown says, yes, the beer was inspired by our April Fool's spoof video this spring, in which we claim to have released a beer made with bull testicles. When we sent out the press release and the video link last April, we heard from brewers and beer writers who thought the beer was for real and loved the idea. So we've turned our joke into a reality. We've been making ballsy beer for the past few years, and this is great proof of that. Brown described the beer as an assertive foreign-style stout, slightly viscous, with a deep brown color. It has equally deep flavors of chocolate syrup, Kahlua, and espresso, along with a palpable level of alcohol and a savory, umami-like note. It finishes dry and roasted with a fast-faded hop bite, he added. Yeah. Rocky Mountain Oyster Stout, named after a local name for fried bull testicles, a delicacy in Colorado, is now on sale at the pub's brewery. Yet another reason why I don't drink. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, Russian prosecutors said administrators at a prison were reprimanded for showing female inmates The Next 3 Days, a movie depicting a jailbreak. Leningrad region prosecutors released a statement saying prison officials signed off on showing the 2010 film despite the plot of the movie involving Russell Crowe's character staging a jailbreak for his wife, played by Elizabeth Banks. The statement said the film fails to promote correction of inmates and prevention of new crimes. The prosecutors reprimanded the prison administrators and confiscated the movie, which the statement dubbed a Hollywood jailbreak manual. Gee, what will they do next in Russia? Show the film Final Destination on flights? Anyway, let's get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, shall we? Actor Kevin Sorbo is probably best known for playing the title role in the television series Hercules. But what a lot of people may not know is that he later had an aneurysm and suffered 3 strokes. Today, Kevin is fully recovered and is now a spokesperson for the American Stroke Association. He is also the author of True Strength, My Journey from Hercules to Mere Mortal, and How Nearly Dying Saved My Life. Kevin joins us on the line right now from California. Hi, Kevin.
Hello, how you doing?
Oh, just tickety-boo. Thanks for being on the program with us. So when this happened to you, I mean, I think the title basically says it, but when this happened to you, I guess you couldn't be prepared for this. I mean, you were a healthy specimen. Didn't this happen to you in the gym?
Well, it was a long road to actually happen. It was I lived in New Zealand for 7 years. That's where I shot the TV series Hercules, and it was near the end of season 5. And I was coming back to shoot a movie here in the States. I was going to shoot a movie in Atlanta for Universal Studios. And about 3 months left of that last season 5, I started getting weird, really achy, throbbing shoulder pains. It was killing me, and I was getting cold fingers. My fingers were cold and numb, and I couldn't figure out what was going on. And when I got back to the States, before I started the movie, I went to my doctor, and he said, you got a lump in your shoulder, and I want to get it biopsied. At the time, he thought it was Hodgkin's. He didn't know for sure, but he didn't tell me this till after everything happened. Well, I went to see my chiropractor, he was working on my shoulder, and he cracked my neck, something that I don't like to have done. He's never done in 8 years. And I asked him why he did it, and he said, I just felt like you needed it. Well, within minutes, I suffered my strokes. And it was later found that the lump in my shoulder and my left subclavicle was an aneurysm, and had been throwing off clots slowly over a 3-4 month period. That's why I was getting the numbness and the achy feelings. But the combination of my neck being snapped sent a couple of the clots up into my brain, and then at that time the aneurysm opened up wide open and sent hundreds of clots on my arms. My arm was purple, and I was dizzy, and I couldn't speak, and my vision was gone, and it was not fun. And I spent the next 2 years living a personal hell, and it took me 3 years to really feel normal again, whatever you want to call normal.
Okay, so 3 years to get back to normal, as you're saying.
Yeah, I mean, I still have repercussions. I still have a 10% loss of vision in both eyes. I have dizzy spells, and I have, when I get overly tired, I get what I call like phantom stroke feelings in a way where I still, the vertigo comes back and all that, but I have to get really tired to have that happen. I mean, I obviously went back down to New Zealand. I couldn't do the movie I was going to shoot in Atlanta, of course. I went through 4 months of rehab to walk again, learn to walk again. Then went down to New Zealand to start season 6 on Hercules, and I was working 14-hour days, and I was down to 1 hour a day when I got back, because that's all I could handle, and slowly worked my way back up to about 8 or 9 hours after season 7 started.
Well, with all that you went through, was it wise to go back to Hercules at the time? I mean...
Well, you know, probably not. I mean, luckily, the studio hid it from everybody. They let out that I had an aneurysm. That was all on ET and, Access Hollywood and all that stuff. But they didn't let out about the strokes, and I'm grateful for that because, number one, I was certainly worried about my health, but, I wanted to have a career. I think that if the strokes came out at that time, it probably would have definitely killed my career. It hurt me enough the way it was dropping out of that movie in the eyes of Hollywood. So, It was a long road to come back, but it gave me hope. It gave me inspiration. It gave me something to look forward to go on the set. And they did stunt casting, bringing a lot of people that were well known, and they did a lot of clip shows where they showed, remember the time I fought the Hydra, and then cut to a clip from season 1 or something like that, just to sort of fill in the hour to keep it going. And I worked my way up slowly. They didn't push me, and they couldn't have pushed me. There's not only so much I could do. Like I said, I went from 14 hours a day to 1 hour a day. Then maybe by the third month, I was up to 2 hours a day. And by the next month, I slowly worked it back up to where it was a manageable schedule for me. But it was a long way for me to get past what I was going through.
Now, that doctor who cracked your neck for you.
Yeah.
Which started all of this. If he hadn't done that, would you essentially have been a ticking time bomb?
Potentially, sure. I think the argument goes both ways. I mean, he could have been blamed for sending the strokes, the clots into my brain, because it's, and now after all these years of being part of this and studying it and finding out about it, the neck manipulation that chiropractors do cause, on average, at least 40 strokes a year in America. So, I've met a lot of people that have suffered these things. I spoke for the American Heart Association down in Palm Beach earlier this year. I met 7 survivors of that, and I met the widows of 2 men that died because of stroke, the manipulation of the neck. But certainly the aneurysm was there, and I don't know if it's a ticking time bomb in terms of giving me strokes, but certainly it would have opened up like it did anyway, and that would have been okay. But, maybe I wouldn't have to go through the strokes of it, because, once you suffered brain damage, you're not a good thing, And I'm fortunate that I was at the level of physical fitness that I was. I mean, at the time I was in better shape, 38 years old, I was in better shape than most 20-year-old athletes. I mean, I was in good shape, and I was everything opposite of what doctors look for in stroke, potential stroke victims. I don't have obesity, I'm not diabetic, I don't smoke, I don't drink, all kinds of things. I don't have high blood pressure, I'm everything opposite. So it was kind of a fluke. I was an anomaly for these guys.
So flash forward, you're now a spokesman for the American Stroke Association, and you've written this book, True Strength. What made you decide, or when did you decide, to do both of these things?
Well, my wife for years said, you really should write a book about what happened to you. I mean, you are a celebrity. People know you. People that knew me from Hercules or even Andromeda, because I went on to shoot a Gene Roddenberry series called Andromeda for 5 years after that, up there in Vancouver, actually. And I've obviously proven that I've gotten healthier. I've shot 60 movies since then as well. So I'm able to do the work. I'm able to do the jobs. But My wife said, this is the time for you to write it, though. You should write it. She bugged me for years, as I said, and I finally said, you know, you're right. This could be inspirational for people. And she coached every step along the way, and we had a lot of, I talked to a lot of people that said, hey, I want you to write a small chapter. And I think we got about 6 or 7 small chapters in there from people on the set of Hercules that were dear friends, my mom, my wife. I mean, everybody wrote a quick chapter to talk about what I went through and the changes they saw in me. And it has proven to be, you know, I'm glad I did it, because I've done a lot of book signings, I've done a lot of readings, and I've met a lot of people that not only have gone through strokes, but maybe they had car accidents or they got cancer or whatever it may be. But it's that, you know, that unseen road that we all are going to be forced to go on one day. And the title True Strength came from that, because it was sort of a play on Hercules, because let's face it, my stunt guys made me look like I was a big stud. And true strength really comes to finding your own true strength when adverse things happen to you in your life and how you handle those things.
You mentioned you did Andromeda after all this had taken place, but was there a period of time there when you were really concerned about getting back into things and that Hollywood wouldn't turn its back on you?
It was initially, that first year was by far the worst down in New Zealand, because, you know, it was very slow to recover. It was very slow. I mean, everything that I had going on was just, it was just horrible. So it was during the second year where I would all of a sudden feel good for 2 days, and then feel, you know, then bad for a month, then good for a week, and then bad for a month. And I knew that I was making ground and things were getting better. So the fact that Universal Studios kept Hercules going, I think, was, and being in New Zealand, was a buffer for me away from the Hollywood paparazzi, so to speak. So it was really, once I got past that first year, I felt, okay, I'm going to be fine. I'm going to make it. Things are going to work out all right.
You mentioned sometimes you have phantom feelings of the stroke. Does it scare you that this could happen again?
No, because I know that it was a fluky thing. I mean, do you live in fear because of it? Yeah, for a while I did. I mean, the doctors kind of warned me, you know, that, because I started suffering panic anxiety attacks. You know, if I stubbed my toe, I said, oh my God, I got cancer. Or, you know, and he, you know, I was warned about some of these things because, you know, they've worked on the stroke victims to see what's happened to them and what their symptoms are afterwards. And, you know, you go through all that. You go through why me, you go through all the anger, you go through all the frustration, you go through all the, you know, railing against the world when it's not the world's fault, but that's sort of our human nature. We blame other people for our failures when they actually have nothing to do with it. But it was a tough road. But I think that's another reason why I wrote the book. I wanted people to say, you know what, you're going to get all kinds of things from family and friends and doctors and whoever, and people are going to set your limitations. Don't let other people set your limitations. You know, you have to believe in yourself. You have to believe in your recovery. My wife gave me a mantra to say every day to myself in the mirror, every day I got up, it was, I'd look at myself and say, I'm getting better, I'm getting stronger. It sounds corny, but it worked. I looked at myself every day and said, you're getting better, you're getting stronger. I would just repeat that all the time and just believe that I would get better. I had to, because I said, there's just no way I'm going to live my life like this.
You mentioned your wife several times. She sounds like an amazingly strong person.
She is. I mean, you know, we're both Christians. I mean, it's something that she's more of a pusher of the faith than I am. I'm a very quiet Christian about it, but I mean, I'll talk to anybody about it. I've got plenty of atheist friends. We've had wonderful debates and conversations about it. We don't get angry at each other. I'm a live and let live kind of guy, but I grew up that way. I've always believed that there's something out there that's sort of watching over all of us. And if I'm wrong, I'm wrong. But if I'm right, then I think I'm on the right path.
Well, even though we didn't know a lot about it at the time it was taking place, I think when fans realize what has happened to you, they'll be very, very happy that you came out of this on the other side relatively unscathed. So it's great to hear. The book is called True Strength, My Journey from Hercules to Mere Mortal and How Nearly Dying Saved My Life. And I thank you very much, Kevin, for taking the time to be on the program with us.
I appreciate it, and please let people know how to get in contact with me. It'd be great, and I got about 8 movies in the can done. I got 2 of them coming out this year, another 3 coming out next year, and I leave next week to shoot one in New Orleans. So, knock on wood, I'm staying busy.
Well, what's the next thing you have coming out?
I'm shooting a faith-based movie down in New Orleans. It's called God Isn't Dead, and ironically, I'm playing a university professor who's an atheist. So it's gonna be fun for me, and it's a pretty cool part. It's a wonderful script.
Well, good thing you had some of those friends, so you can use them for research.
Exactly.
Thank you very much, Kevin.
All right, thank you. Appreciate it.
Actor Kevin Sorbo. His book is True Strength, My Journey from Hercules to Mere Mortal and How Nearly Dying Saved My Life. You can check out his website at kevinsorbo.net, and you can go to my website at thestufffile.com And look on the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0165, and you'll find links to Kevin's site. You'll also find links to Amazon.com and Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly.
You're listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of the Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick, if you know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands, just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
You're listening to The Stuff File, now with 25% fewer calories. Here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk to the author of Blood Beneath My Feet, plus we'll have a visit from Peter Franklin, the Gabby Cabby, and we'll have an idiot of the day on the Stuff File program, heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. And by the way, you can vote for this show for the first annual Stitcher Awards. You can nominate and vote for the best in on-demand radio across 20 different categories. Listeners can vote once a day for the next couple of weeks, right till the end of October, at Stitcher's site or on their Facebook page, and all shows and podcasts available on Stitcher, and there's about 10,000 of them, if not more, are eligible for consideration, and shows may be nominated in multiple award categories. Winners will be announced live at the Stitcher Awards show in San Francisco at the end of the year. You can just go to their website. You can vote at stitcher.com/StitcherAwards, and please remember to vote for the Stuff File program if you do indeed enjoy it. Thank you very much. Let's get right back to the stuff, shall we? Police say Tyler A. Myers, age 19, of Norwalk, Ohio, ran a stop sign in his pickup truck and was broadsided by a semi. He was pronounced dead at the scene. Investigators think before the crash, Myers was up to no good. He was, they say, stealing stop signs. Three stolen stop signs from intersections along his path to the crash were found in his truck. The stolen signs were replaced before any other crashes occurred. Okay, that's what I call poetry meets karma. That's what I'm saying. And as you know on this program, we often say everything happens at Walmart. Here's another story. Julia Garcia tried to pay cash for her shopping, but says the cashier at the San Jose, Texas Walmart tore up the $100 bill she presented, and then a manager destroyed a second one. Garcia says the store held her for 2 hours while customers were told that she was trying to use fake money. When police finally arrived and confirmed the bills were real, the manager tried to return the torn-up cash. In a lawsuit, Garcia says the store employees declared the currency fake without bothering to test them. I can't wait to see how Walmart tries to pay for the damages. I'm assuming it won't be in cash. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, here's another great story from what I would like to call on this show the Nanny State, a.k.a. the U.K., the United Kingdom. The Isambard Community School in Swindon, Wilts, England, has decreed that no parent can watch their own child play school sports until they have passed a criminal background check to show that they are not child molesters. I couldn't believe it, said Neil Park, who was turned away when he showed up for his 12-year-old's rugby game. What are they going to stop you from going to next? Parents' evening? The school play? School officials are standing firm, even though a spokesman said the school staff have been on the receiving end of verbal abuse from parents who have become frustrated trying to get into or out of the school. Wait a minute, now they're keeping parents in the school too? I thought detention ended when you graduated. I'm just wondering, have all the school staffers who are keeping parents locked in, have they been cleared? Just checking. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Joseph Scott Morgan is a retired medico-legal death investigator and the author of the book Blood Beneath My Feet, The Journey of a Southern Death Investigator. He joins us on the line right now from Georgia. Hi, Joseph.
Hi, Peter. How are you?
Just tickety-boo. Thanks for being on the program with us. So, first of all, the subtitle of your book, The Journey of a Southern Death Investigator. Are death investigations different in the South?
I believe that we have a particular way, some people would say a peculiar way, of looking at both life and death. I would think that there are a number of differences, at least when I've gotten together with colleagues over the years from various places all over the world and talked about our profession. For me, being a Southern death investigator is the only type of death investigator that I've ever known, because I was born in the southern U.S. In Louisiana, began my career there in New Orleans, and finished my career in Atlanta, Georgia.
Now, we have seen grisly death scenes dramatized in television and movies, but I understand that what we see in TV and in movies is somewhat of a sanitized version of what you used to see on a regular basis when you went to crime scenes.
Yes, that's very accurate. I think the thing that your absence and all of those Jerry Bruckheimer-esque portrayals that are out there are the facts that you're missing out on the other senses, the smell. Even the sound has a tactile sense to it. You're around families, the mourning screams of a mother that's lost a child. All of those, your senses are completely assaulted on every level. Even the textures of things are appreciable. And so this has a lingering effect on an individual that actually practices as a medical legal death investigator. And that's the seminal point in my book. I've tried to open a discussion about the price that's paid by individuals such as myself that chose of our own free will to be around death for as long as someone like myself was for over 20 years, and ask bigger questions. Why would you choose to subject yourself to just the horrible conditions that you bore witness to day in and day out? And I try to get some answers for those questions, and I still don't know that I have them, but it's certainly the start of an exploration.
Well, I understand over the two decades that you did this job, you conducted probably more than 7,000 autopsies. Obviously, that has some kind of effect on a person's psyche. If you were to choose a profession again, would you do it all over again?
That's a great question. I have to tell you, Peter, and I'm saying this metaphorically, of course we all use computers now, but when I took up the pen finally outside of the technical realm and started to write, this catharsis that took place within me made me lament the fact that I had an MFS, which is a Master's in Forensic Science, as opposed to an MFA. I wish I could have spent my adult life on one level. I don't say wish I could have. I'm thankful for the life that I've had, but if I could have the chance to do it over, I wish that I could have been creating things instead of bearing witness to those things that had been destroyed. And there's a sickly sadness to that, I think. And I'm hoping that with the book that I'm imparting that to people. I don't want it to be for naught. I want to put a face on death relative to those of us that kind of try to describe it to everyone else that's out there that doesn't have a clue, you know, as to what's going on. An interesting little slice of life. When my wife and I started dating, I was working with the medical examiner's office as an investigator, a senior investigator in Atlanta with the ME's office, and we were over dinner one night, and I guess this probably about four dates into our relationship, and she just stopped in mid meal and looked at me and she says, "You know, I never thought about death until I've met you." And you know, it's kind of comical, you know, when you think about that statement, but most of the world does not. It just kind of passes us by. Most people do not see the potential for death. And unfortunately, those of us that have worked in the field, we see it everywhere. And we pay a price for it, as I did in the end. Death almost robbed me of everything that I had. I'm lucky I survived.
How did you survive? What put on the brakes for you?
Well, interestingly enough, the very last day I left my job with the Fulton County Medical Examiner's Office in Atlanta was actually in the back of an ambulance. That was in the spring of 2004. I was placed in the back of an ambulance because for the third time or the fourth time in 3 months or the third time in 4 months, I thought that I was having a heart attack. This time I really thought that it was over for me. You know, radiating chest pains, you know, shortness of breath, sweating, all the classic signs that I had read about and queried people about for years and years in cases that I've worked. And when I was finally taken to a major hospital in downtown Atlanta, after being in there for 2 days and going through testing, the cardiologist came in and said, "Mr. Morgan, there's absolutely nothing wrong with your heart. I'm sorry to say, but I believe that you probably need a psychiatrist." And keep in mind, by this time, I'd had tremors for a couple of years, and I tried to hide them from people. I would shake, had had nightmares for any number of years, and I was just living a day-to-day existence, just trying to survive. And you know, I look at him and I think, you know, here I am. I'm this flinty-faced, you know, Southern male that can, trudge on into the maelstrom and endure anything. You know, rugged individualist and all this thing. And I'm thinking, man, are you out of your mind? I don't need a psychiatrist. I can do anything. And it turned out that I could. It turned out that it had robbed me of everything that I thought that I was. I thought it was something special. I thought that I don't want to be cheap here and say I thought that I could cheat death. No one cheats it, and I was certainly acutely aware of that. But I thought that I had a handle on it. And I don't think that we're necessarily created in this world to bear witness to the things that many in my field are required to bear witness to day in and day out.
How long have you been out of the field?
Let's see, now since 2005 was my official separation date. Now I teach forensic science at North Georgia College and State University in Dahlonega, Georgia, in the Blue Ridge Mountains, and I teach undergraduate students, and I'm a part of a forensics program, and I teach an actual undergraduate class in death investigation. And, Peter, I've kind of taken the attitude. I've been given this opportunity to do this, and, I teach them the basics of death investigation, but also I try to use my life and my experiences as a cautionary tale of you know, not to be enamored with what you've seen on television. And I try to put a real taste of it to them, so that they'll come away with an understanding. I've actually had a couple of kids that have been around me have read my book, and they have said, you know, Professor Morgan, I had every intent of being of becoming, you know, homicide detective or death investigator like you were. That's really what I wanted to do. And after reading your book, I decided that the potential for the price that I was going to pay was just going to be too much, and it's turned me off. that's turned me off. And you know what? I celebrate that. I truly do, because it is one heck of a price to have to pay.
So now when you turn on your TV or go to the movies and you see an autopsy being depicted or one of those investigations take place on a CSI show, what do you see that we don't?
I see foolishness to a great degree. I see the lack of a substantive, concrete reality. I think the thing that gets me so much is the cleanliness that's portrayed. I see the people not actually paying a price. And when I say people, I'm not talking about the dead or even the families. I'm talking about the investigators. Because please understand this, Peter, the field that I was in is very select. We're not homicide cops. We work in America, either for the coroner or for the medical examiner, depending upon what type of system. We're the eyes and the ears of the forensic pathologists in the field. And in the U.S., there, when I got out of the profession, there were only about 680 of us nationwide that performed my job duties as a full-time investigator. And so there's a very select group of us. It's very small. And I'm not saying that we're smarter than anybody else or anything like that. I'm just saying that, you know, like they say with firemen, you know, we're the ones that run into the house when there's a bloated, decomposing body in there, when everybody else is leaving. For me, it started out with a scientific curiosity. And also, I think a lot of baggage from a really difficult childhood where I was trying to prove that I was the man. I was the man to go to. And it turned out that I stayed in it a little bit too long.
The book is called Blood Beneath My Feet, The Journey of a Southern Death Investigator. And Joseph, I thank you very, very much for being on the program with us, but don't sell yourself short. You know, 7,000 autopsies, 7,000 opportunities to give closure to families and find answers for the person who was the deceased.
Right. I've tried to look at it that way. I was a pathology assistant. I worked on autopsies in addition to going out in the field and investigating cases. And, of course, notifying families. Contrary to what you see on television, in the U.S., it's generally someone like me that's going to show up at the door to notify the family. And this is the rub, I think. You like to think that you've given people closure, that you've helped them. The problem with this is those families that are touched by death, one way or another, they're going to move forward, hopefully. They'll get therapy or, you know, they'll just hug one another a little tighter and move on with their lives. And the chance that someone else like myself is going to show up at their door and notify them is, those chances are remote. However, if you're a medical legal death investigator, you essentially go about your day delivering this news, and it's almost like you walk up to a home of a total stranger, open the door, throw a hand grenade in, and close the door. And you hear the screams, you hear the horror, you bear witness to all of this, and then you move to the next one. And so you spend, it's a cumulative effect, you spend the next few years of your life doing this over and over and over and over again. And the death investigator cannot never move on. The only thing you move on to is the next notification or the next horrific scene. And I would love to take solace in the fact that I have bought closure to some people, but it's outweighed by this just burdensome grief, you know, that you carry in your person, because you can't forget all of the images that you've seen, and you can't forget all of the screams that you've heard over the years. So that's the most difficult part.
Joseph, I thank you very much for being on the program with us.
Peter, you're so kind, and thanks to your audience for listening to me.
Joseph Scott Morgan, author of Blood Beneath My Feet, The Journey of a Southern Death Investigator. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0165, and you'll find links to Joseph's site. You'll also find links to Amazon.com and Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRigo Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. Have you ever wondered if a judge can serve on a jury? Well, they can, and every once in a while, a judge is called for jury duty. Sometimes the attorneys for both parties will actually allow a judge to become part of the jury. Of course, a judge can't serve on a jury in a trial he or she is presiding over, but it's a good reminder that anyone can serve on a jury. I was on a jury recently, and it reminded me of how important this responsibility is. Now, I know many people try to avoid jury duty, and that a comedian once joked that when you go into court, you're putting your fate into the hands of 12 people who weren't smart enough to get out of jury duty. But let's be fair, if you had to go to court and your freedom or your livelihood were on the line, wouldn't you want at least some of the jurors to have the same kind of experience you have? I would. Like voting, jury duty is a privilege. It's one we're lucky to have, and one that many brave Americans have died defending. Learn more. Visit our website at centerforamerica.org.
Latitude, 47 degrees, 14 minutes north. Longitude, 84 degrees, 39 minutes west. Location, Montreal, Canada. This is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Now, the Stuff File presents the Gabby Cabby, direct from his yellow mobile conveyance lounge in the city that never sleeps, New York. Once again, here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And once again, we do indeed have Peter Franklin, the Gabby Cabby from New York City. Hello, sir.
Hello, hello, live from the streets of New York.
Yes, and here we are in the fall season. Now, I did see the movie A Tree Grows in Brooklyn, so I know you have some sort of foliage. Do you have lovely fall colors yet?
No, not yet. The leaves are where they belong, still on the trees. I mean, there's a few sprinkling of it, but not really. I don't know. It's kind of weird. The weather is completely weird. We used to have four distinct seasons in New York City. Now I'm not so sure. So we'll see what happens. But so far, no, not the usual New England-type leaf falling.
Okay. Now, one of the stories I want to talk about has to do with some local museums that have some artwork stolen by the Nazis. Really?
Yeah, better late than never to start investigating a crime. It's fairly common knowledge among historians that the Nazis stole about 600 million pieces of artwork, paintings, sculpture, and all that. They took it from museums all over Europe. They took it from rich people's homes, and they kept it. And eventually, a lot of it has dribbled back into the market, but not necessarily back to the owners. So now they're discovering that the Metropolitan Museum of Art, the Museum of Modern Art, the Brooklyn Museum, and even the Jewish Museum have some of this stuff. So I guess the authorities thought, well, it'd be no problem. Why don't you guys just give it all back? And therein lies the problem. Who do you give it back to at this point? You know, unless you can show it was clearly owned by some particular family or particular institution, the problem is you just can't hand it back to somebody. So it's a little bit of a scandal brewing, which will probably involve maybe a lot of museums across the United States, and who knows, even Canada.
Now, are these pieces that the museum owns, or are these pieces that were loaned to the museum from somebody?
No, there may be, but basically these are pieces they bought, which they're now saying in good faith, They bought it thinking things that were up for sale, and they had no knowledge at all. I can assure you when the director of the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York City says, gee, just because there were swastikas all over the crate, no, I'm only kidding, of course. No, they're claiming they didn't know, which might be true.
It's interesting because I just finished watching an episode of the television series White Collar, an old episode of White Collar, which had this as a plot line. So one of the things I have to ask is, and maybe I don't know if you know this or not, but wouldn't, if you were a museum and somebody came to you with a piece of artwork, either you knew of it or you didn't know of it, if you knew its history, wouldn't you think it might have been stolen?
So are you asking me whether or not I would be an honest person?
No, okay, yeah, let's go there.
And you're asking a museum? Let me tell you something, kiddo. I guarantee you that half the stuff in the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York City probably isn't even there. It's as much as I would trust some of these museums. So, you know, I don't find it. They just closed their eyes and just bought and bought and bought and never bothered to ask any questions.
Hmm. Interesting. Well, beauty is, or art is in the eye of the beholder, I guess. Anyway.
Exactly. Very profound.
I understand, turning to another story, that firefighters are selling their old gear, and they're not supposed to do this, are they?
No, not at all. In other words, it's sort of like in the Army, the American Army, probably the Canadian Army. When you're leaving the Army, you're leaving the fire department or leaving the police department, you're not supposed to, you know, take the stuff with you. Now, we're not talking about your underwear, your socks, but certainly your uniform, or maybe you might keep one, I guess, and that's probably not completely legal. But it now turns out that firemen in the city of New York, which has been called, by the way, by the U.S. federal government as the most racist fire department in the United States. I can't imagine why, just because 97% of the people on the New York City Fire Department are white males. But that's another story. Anyway, they find that these guys have been selling the stuff on eBay. What's even worse, they've been selling keys. You know, a lot of the firehouses have keys that will open this building, open that building, turn on this, turn off that. So it's on eBay. So right now our city council is looking, and it's probably prevalent on other fire departments throughout the country, the city council is looking in some ways to see if they can kind of control it by having eBay cooperate and not letting it be there. But if past experience is anything, you know, eBay would sell your grandmother's teeth. So I don't know how it's all going to end up. They also are afraid that somebody dressed up as a fireman gets very quick access to any building or any place. And with all the terrorism that may be floating around, you certainly don't want three or four guys walking into some situation looking like New York City firemen and then turning out not to be.
Now, the keys you're referring to, these aren't keys to fire buildings, are they? Are these like master keys to get into warehouses and stuff, or what?
Exactly. I mean, in other words, the fire department can get into just about anything. And they can do it by having sets of keys. It's sort of like, you know, in New York City, the custom, although I have never followed it and I never will follow it, is if you live in an apartment house in New York City, you're supposed to give a copy of the keys to the superintendent of the building.
Right.
Peter, hold your breath before I ever do that.
Okay. Meanwhile, I understand there was a fellow who was robbed. They stole his flute. Now, there's a joke in there somewhere, but seriously.
There isn't. You see, that's the point. I thought to myself, he's a poor guy. He's a flautist. I guess that's what they say, a flautist. And he has this flute, and he's walking along on the street, and somebody comes up to him, who's in the case, he was carrying it. Somebody comes up to him, holds him up, and takes the flute and goes off. And I keep having this vision of this being like a Woody Allen movie or something or other, where the perpetrator said, you know, your flute or your life. So I feel bad for the guy. I feel bad for anybody who gets something stolen. But you're right. There is something almost funny or a joke about having your flute robbed on the streets of New York.
Actually, your flute or your life, that sounds very Jack Benny.
Well, okay, or your trumpet, right? The one blows at midnight.
Oh, that's true, too, but, yeah. Anyway.
Well, see, you're not the only person who knows trivia. I know my trivia, too.
And let's talk about, since we're talking to a New York cabbie, let's talk about the ads on New York taxis. I understand this is causing a bit of concern.
Yeah, every New York City cab, or almost every New York City cab, and there's about 13,000 of them, has a thing on the top where you can put an ad, you know, like a little bit of a billboard sign. And it's a way of getting extra money for the owners of the cabs. You know, and it gets pretty good exposure because, you know, average cab is driving around all over Manhattan or the Bronx or Queens, and people are getting to see the ad. The problem is that some of the ads are for these sleazy strip joints, which we still have in New York City. And there are a number of cab drivers who don't like the idea of driving a cab around the streets of New York that have the ads. Because remember, in New York City, the cabs are really not owned by the cab drivers. They just really lease them for the shift. So this week, the stupid, and yes, I said stupid, taxi commission comes out and says, what's everybody making a big deal about it? The cab drivers don't care, really, and we're not getting any complaints, so why are people trying to stir up trouble? Well, nothing could be further from the truth, because do you know what happens if a cab driver goes to the garage to take out a cab for his shift, and it has one of these dirty kind of ads on it, and he says, I won't take a cab? What do you think is the possibility of him getting a cab from that garage again? It's sort of like, if you don't take this cab on Monday, don't bother coming in on Tuesday.
Mm. So I guess nobody's saying no. Nobody's saying they're afraid to. Okay.
You know, I mean, I mean, at least there is one tough New York City cab driver. That's me, you know. But you see, I'm a universal bigot. I hate everybody for everything, so I don't have a problem. But there are some cab drivers that don't like certain things on top of their cabs, and I can see that, and that they should be protected.
Now, speaking of something a little on the racy side, although I saw the pictures on your website, it wasn't too racy, I don't think. But anyway, I understand there's a guidance counselor who is in a little bit of trouble in NYC.
Not a bad-looking broad, huh?
No, not at all.
She turns out that she's an $84,000-a-year guidance counselor in the New York City school system. And that picture surfaced of her, and now all your listeners are running to see it on Gabby.com. That picture surfaced on the internet, and she's been fired. A three-man panel has decided that she must have some kind of immorality because, now, you ready for the punchline? She posed for that picture 20 years ago. She's probably a grandma now. So most people here think it's very unfair for whatever she did in her youth. And as a matter of fact, I think as soon as her young boy students see that picture, they're all going to want to go to her for guidance. So she's not going to have an attendance problem.
Now, do we know she was working with the school system 20 years ago when the picture was taken?
No.
Okay.
She wasn't. But even if she was, that was the last picture that was taken of her. And it was taken 20 years ago.
Right.
And so most people here think it's unfair. And she'll sue, and she'll probably get a good high-priced attorney or something who'll get her a job back. But it was all the topic of conversation, and everybody was drooling over the picture this week.
Now, I noticed that the you have her picture and you have her name there. You got to admit, her first name is Tiffany. That does sound like a stripper name.
Well, I don't. But again, I mean, yeah, that may be. I don't care what. But she did it 20 years ago.
I agree. I'm with you. And to me, it's an innocent-looking picture. I don't know what they're getting all upset about. As a matter of fact, it'll get more circulation because of what they've done than just finding the picture. But anyway.
Yeah, and this way, now we got everybody to go look at my website.
At Gabby.com, you'll see it there.
Clever marketing.
Absolutely. Now, do you have a celebrity sighting for this week?
Give me a hint because I don't remember.
I think I saw on the site I'll give you the full name. George Clooney.
Okay.
How do you forget that?
No, yes, I do, because when you're in New York City, I always like to point out to people that if I say I saw a celebrity, it's not a big deal because everybody here sees celebrities. The problem is you don't generally recognize them. Because of the fact that they're usually wearing a baseball hat about a week or so ago, I saw Lily Tomlin, and I didn't at first realize who it was. So now I saw Clooney, and he was just walking on the street on Fifth Avenue with, I guess, some friends, and they were talking. And it was amazing the number of people. Here's a guy who got one of the most famous faces in the world. Guys walking along on Fifth Avenue, and nobody was even turning their head because nobody realized who he was. Now, just as a little piece of gossip, which will probably get you sued and me sued, I think he's had a facelift. But I can't prove that.
Okay. I bet you that most of the celebrities who walk around New York City usually turn and go, there's Peter Franklin, the Gabby Cabbie.
Yeah, and has he had a facelift?
Peter, it's always a pleasure. People can take a look at your website, which has Tiffany's picture on it, at www.gabby.com. They can also send you an email to peter@gabby.com. I thank you once again for being on the program, sir.
Well, thank you. Thank you. Bye.
The Stuff File.
And we're just about done with this edition of the Stuff File program. We just have one more thing to share with you, and that would be the idiot of the day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. The Stuff File presents the Idiot of the Day.
Dakota Guerin, age 19, was arrested in Vancouver, Washington in September on suspicion of stealing an antique coin collection in May that was estimated to be worth $100,000. Guerin and his girlfriend were identified after spending some of the coins at a movie theater and a pizza restaurant using rare Liberty Head quarters worth anywhere from $5 to $18,500, and they were using them at their face value. Now, I, for the life of me, can't begin to analyze how dumb this is. So I'll just cut to the chase, and I'll simply say, Dakota Guerin, you are an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program number 0165. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's number 0165. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder. And don't forget to check out the Stuff File store, where you can purchase a plethora of Stuff File merchandise, from t-shirts to mugs to tote bags to mouse pads. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberstationUSA.com, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, streaming on PCJ Media and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on iTunes and Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
Been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. Any rebroadcast of this copywritten program in whole or in part without the express written consent of... Oh, God, who the hell are we kidding? Who's going to steal this show? God, who writes this stuff? Holder, what a kidder.